Good morning.
Good morning. And I really will start from saying that I'm really honored to share the stage with you.
I'm honored to share the stage with you as well. This is great. Thank you.
And when Brian asked me to moderate the session, I also tried to look at it from, you know, from the audience perspective. And I thought the session, I mean, like usually the last sessions are, should serve as a dessert. You have a long session, a lot of information, and that's a dessert. Mm-hmm. However, I arrived on Wednesday, and I arrived earlier than originally scheduled because of Ryan rescheduling. So I attended your session, training session, and there I realized that the dessert was already served. We had it all. I mean, 70% of us there were there, and you had the entree, you know, the first course, the main course, the dessert, everything. Everything was there. So what should we do? There is one thing that is left. It's digestif. And what is digestif? It's something that helps you to digest, surely, in order to take on more information later on.
Right.
But digestif is something very condensed. So I want to kick off the session with a series of short questions with even shorter answers from your side.
Okay.
So brief. You are, I ask you to say 1 to 3 words to every question you receive. Later on, my questions will get longer, your answers will get longer too. Later on, we'll start to turn to you because I'm sure that you still have some questions to ask. But let's kick off.
All right.
Who's the best speaker? Who is the best speaker besides the Lama? We know who's the best speech writer, but who's the best speaker?
Living? Dead? Ever?
Ever.
Mm.
First comes
American, anyone.
Oh, come on. Just try the name.
This is hard.
Just say God.
I know. 3 words. I like John F. Kennedy.
Kennedy. Could you describe your overall experience in the White House with one word?
Humbling.
The best or the dearest speech that you've ever written? I mean, preferably from Obama.
For me personally.
Yeah.
I spoke about this in the workshop, a speech he gave after the Boston Marathon bombing, at a memorial service. Because I'm from there and it meant a lot to me to be able to work on that.
Good. What's the one word you hate in political speeches? Is there any word?
So many words.
1 to 3.
Leverage.
What is one advice you would give to any new incoming White House speechwriter?
One word, 3 words.
Okay.
You're very. One word. Listen.
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 Was there any kind of any rule that don't do this under any circumstances in the White House?
No. It's one word.
What is the one thing you learned from Obama?
Tell a story.
Is there any person you would still wish to write a speech or write more speeches? Except Obama, surely.
No, I can say more than 3 words, right? I was so grateful to have those 8 years. Some people have asked me, do you wish you were still back there? And I'm just so grateful for those 8 years that if I never wrote another speech again, I'd be okay. I really feel that way. I'm proud of the work I did. It was exhausting. It was hard on my family. But no, actually, I feel very fulfilled by having that experience. And now I enjoy sharing that experience with other people more than anything. That's not three words, but that's what I feel.
It's fine.
It's what I feel in my heart.
Into the longer sessions.
Right, right. Here we go.
Do you plan to write a book?
I think I will. I think I will.
Do you have the title for it already?
we were just talking about this morning. I have a title in my head. I don't think it's the right title, but it's one that's helping me organize my thoughts.
Okay, last question from the short ones. Who, and I will really ask you not to think very long before answering, okay?
Okay, I can do that. Speak before thinking. I can. This is one of our problems.
Who is more important, the speaker or the audience, to you?
I have to choose.
Surely you have to choose. That's the question.
This may seem at odds with what I said in the workshop, but I mean, if I have to choose, it's the speaker, because in most cases, you don't get to pick the audience. But you do have to tailor your speaker to the audience. So I start from the entry point of the speaker. The speaker.
Good.
Speaker, that's one word. All right. That's hard.
Okay, so you survived the
lightning round. All right.
And now we'll go to longer questions.
Okay.
With the longer answers, surely. As a speechwriter, when you start to write speeches for one particular person, you try to feel him or her, you try to sense.
Can we just use the microphone? It's okay, I think everyone can hear you.
We'll just talk up.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
All right. We'll project.
Yeah. So when you start to work for one person, you try to feel the person.
Mm-hmm.
You start hearing his or her voice in your head.
Right.
Do you still have Obama's voice in your head? When you write or when you speak, do you notice that, oh, that's Obama and me speaking or writing?
No, actually, it went away pretty quick. Since leaving, I've helped with a few little things here and there with him, and suddenly the voice comes back. But I work with other people now, and their voices are the ones in my head. Right, speechwriters are schizophrenic here. We hear voices all day long. And if you're writing for multiple people, you're hearing many voices in your head all at once. So, but no, actually, I've talked about this in the workshop. One of the things I try to do is really, if it's a public speaker where you can play their speeches on your computer screen and just close your eyes and listen, it's a great way to just sort of get in the right space, and I try to do that. I heard someone say once, well, I just write in a generic voice for my clients. Well, I don't know why they're hiring you, frankly, because every one of us has our own unique voice. We have our own unique story, and there's 80 people in here. And if we all had to give a speech on the same thing, they should be 80 different speeches, with 80 different sense of voice. So I try very hard to immerse myself in that person's voice.
Mm. Okay, I thought that I will not ask that question, or I will not do that exercise, but you kind of now, with your answer, you're reminded of that exercise. So sometimes in the speech writing course, at the very beginning, trying to get the future writers to get more into the person's head to whom they are writing,
mm-hmm.
I give an exercise saying, just write shortly any association that you have with the person. So I will give you a series of questions that I usually ask,
okay.
And you'll get the answer. So for us also to sense what kind of Obama you had in you. Good?
All right, man,
okay,
this is tough.
One word. Sorry, coming back to the show.
One word again.
It's okay.
This is hard. I tell people be brief, but that's two words.
Sorry.
But we can do it.
C'est la vie.
Yeah.
Okay, you describe with one word what who Obama would be if he would be a plant.
A plant?
A plant.
I don't know much about plants.
A flower.
Oh. Well, palm tree.
Palm tree?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. An animal.
A Pass.
Pass. A car.
A car?
A car.
Ferrari.
Mm-hmm. Profession. If not a lawyer and president yet.
Professor.
Professor. Adjective.
Erudite.
Mm-hmm. What others say about him?
Depends on who you are. Inspiring.
Inspiring. Yeah, so.
An inspiring palm tree. There we go. Three words.
Yeah, that was a test. So I think that's also a feeling, you know, to whom you were writing. Inspiring
right.
palm tree. Good. At the course, you gave a short video with Obama saying hello in various languages to mm-hmm. the audiences he was visiting. Did he have any particular techniques that he liked in the beginning of the speech, or how he would start the speech, that his favorite one?
Well, I think the reason we made that video is because it was something he really enjoyed doing. You know, we didn't have someone ask me, was it hard to convince him to do things like that? And it never was. I think he just understood how important it is to try to reach out to people and meet them where they are and show some respect. There's literally no better, you know, there's no better way to show respect than literally speak someone else's language or to try. And, you know, Americans aren't really known for doing that always around the world. Sometimes we go to a lot of places and the first question is, do you speak English? So we thought it'd be nice if sometimes, a lot of times, the first words out of the President of the United States' mouth was something that they recognize. And to try to forge that emotional connection with the audience, whether oftentimes, by the time he would give that speech, he had been in the country for a day or two. He had gone out on meals. He had been sightseeing. He had seen things. He'd experienced things. We would try to put that right up in front to show that he was experiencing the same things that they experience every day. And it means a lot to people, I think, you know, whether you're a tourist or whether you're the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so that he enjoyed it. In the video that you saw that I showed, he enjoyed it a lot, and he got the feedback. We've talked a lot about the feedback loop you get from your audience. It was wonderful. It was wonderful for the audience. It was wonderful for him.
But those were mainly the speeches that he delivered at Walt.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when he was at home?
Yeah, I mean, I still think he's tried to root a lot of his speeches in some sort of story of connection that he had with that city or that town. Previous visit he had, talking about what he did the last time. Again, just these very basic human connections. You don't have to, you know, we think of oratory and we think of rhetoric and it's up here and, you know, it doesn't always have to be, I mean, that's not very accessible for a lot of people. It creates space and distance between a speaker and the audience. So I'm a firm believer that you go to where people are,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So after the start of the speech, describe a little bit how was the process of the speech writing. So the routine, the kitchen. So you knew that, you know, the president is going to, I don't know, Botswana or
mm-hmm.
to, how, you know, how the process looked like.
It was easy and it was fun. Yeah, or the opposite. So yeah. So for a speech like that, a foreign trip, a big speech overseas, it would start weeks and weeks in advance. And one of the first things that I would do as a speechwriter is we'd reach out to our embassy in that country and ask them to make sure they were working closely with the local staff, people who actually live in that country, from that country. And we would give them, you know, all sorts of questions, you know, the local sayings, the foods, the events, what's going on in that country, what are people focused on? We really wanted to make sure that he wasn't just sort of airdropping in with his agenda and his mission and his priorities. He certainly had all that, but let's understand where they are, what they care about, and see where they overlap. Going back to your question, what's more important, speaker, audience? I mean, you forced me to pick. I picked speaker. I've always viewed it as a bit of a Venn diagram, right? This is the audience. This is their experience, what they care about, what their interests are, what their priorities are, what they want in life. And then there's your speaker and what they're trying to do and they're trying to achieve. And hopefully there's some overlap there. That's where the speech is. That's where the speech lives. And The more you think, the more you research, maybe you can identify more overlap, more commonalities. And so that gives you more space to write the speech. But, you know, for, again, a big speech like that where I talked about in the workshop, maybe 60% of my time personally, I'll do research and learning and reading. So weeks of research, weeks of learning, weeks of reaching out to the policy experts to see what they would like him to say. Doesn't mean he's going to, what you would like him to say. And so by the end, you know, maybe a week out, we have this massive, I have this massive document, 100 pages or more, and it's quotes and it's stories and it's anecdotes and it's the foods they eat and the teams they like and the sports they love and then the 10 policy points. And you sort of look at all that and say, how can we bring that all together in something that's interesting and engaging and compelling, forges a connection with the audience, so that by the end, they're left with this feeling, this is someone who understands me, who shares my values, who shares my vision, who, like, you know, let's go there together. Because that's really what, when the President of the United States is traveling overseas, he or she is basically saying, this is what we have in common, this is what we can do together. You know, you have a lot of countries to choose from. Other countries are offering you a different deal. China may be offering you a very different deal. Here's why we want to work with you. Here's why I think you should work with us. So, you know, again, process. For a big speech, the president might see it a few days out, and it goes up to him. He gets his homework. You know, he reads, he writes, he rewrites. We get it back. Usually, by the day of, it's done. But President Obama had a habit of editing right up until the last minute. We'd be in a room, in a small room next to the stage. Could hear the crowd cheering, stomping their feet, getting ready, the music's playing. And he's still making edits and handing us the edits, and you know, we're sort of furiously typing them in. He would edit right up until the last minute. So weeks of work, weeks of preparation, weeks of research, but then still at the very last minute. And I think his theory was, you know, it was agonizing for us, but why not make it better? You have 5 minutes. Spend 5 minutes making it better. But
did you have any record on how many times he rewritten, or you had to rewrite the speech?
We would date stamp them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we would number them. It can get a little demoralizing after a while. Draft 32, you know.
And I listened to a few of your interviews before preparing for this, and I remember in one of them you saying that you never read a book about the speech writing.
That's right. I never took a course. I never read a book about speech writing.
Mm-hmm. So, but you're gonna write one about it.
Why not?
You know. But what was your inspiration then? I mean, what was your reference? You spent a lot of time, a lot of effort in preparing and researching and analyzing. Mm-hmm. But what was your kind of key resources for that inspiration?
I had some great mentors. You know, I guess I'm one of those people, I just learned by doing. And I don't know if it was good or bad that I didn't have the theory behind it. I mean, I'll tell you the God's honest truth, and you may laugh at this, and I had never heard of ethos, pathos, and logos until after I finished writing for Obama. I'd never taken a course. I'd never had. So I told the workshop, the first time I ever got a chance to write a real speech or play any role was when I was an intern at the White House for President Bill Clinton. And they started letting me write drafts of things. And they had to completely rewrite them. It was very demoralizing. I was 20 years old, and I have this incredible opportunity, but they're rewriting everything I'm doing. And so clearly I didn't know what I was doing. But they never sat down and said to me, you know what you really need here? More ethos. No one ever, in 25 years, no one has ever said that to me. But they would say, you know, let's have him talk about being president here, even though everyone knows he's president. You know, this is a kind of moment, usually national security foreign policy moments. It's a little odd, isn't it? A lot of American presidents do this. As president of the United States, the security of the American people is my highest priority. Why does he need to say, as president of the United States? We know that. What's going on there? He's sending, it's this, as if you didn't know, he's reminding you of his role, his authority, his credibility. But I learned by doing, and I had mentors that taught me. And one of the, for those of you who weren't there, Bill Clinton had three foreign policy speechwriters when I was there. And those were the speechwriters that I was assigned to who rewrote everything I did. And one of them was named Tony Blinken, who's now the Secretary of State of the United States. So, you know, speechwriters do cool things. So.
But inside, among the speechwriters, were there any speeches that were considered more important than others that everyone would seek to ever write or?
Well, I can tell you the one speech people would seek not to write.
I'm sure I know.
State of the Union. A beast, it's not pretty. The process is ugly. No one would fight for that. But no, you know, when it's at the President of the United States level, whenever they go out, even if it's a short speech, the whole world still sees it. So you still have the opportunity to deliver something big and important, inspiring, or to make a mistake. So everything's important. We didn't really see it that way, if that makes sense. Because, you know, whether it's a quote unquote small event or a big event, there's still 100 cameras there, and it's still the president speaking to the whole world. So. You know, we were lucky, and I say we were. I've seen other speechwriting offices over the years, other administrations. You know, the personalities get so big, and everyone's kind of jockeying. We were so lucky to have a team where we're all still friends. We all still keep in touch. We all still share ideas sometimes. And I think that reflects, you know, the person at the top. You know, if you have a boss who's vindictive and mean and mean-spirited, that seeps into an organization. One of the greatest boss. I mean, put politics aside, whether you're left or right, we should all be so lucky to work for a person like this, who the way he treated us and the way, even when he was disappointed with a speech, and we knew he was disappointed, I told the story, you know, this is a good 6-page speech. It would be a great 5-page speech. Or, you know, this is good. But I don't have to give it for 3 days, which means we have 3 days to make it great. You know, and you know, your heart sinks a little bit because you know it's not great yet. But you do have to go back, and I think that just speaks to his character as a person. And I hope not all of us have bosses like that, but we should all. And if when we are the boss, we should try to be like that. I think.
Did you have, in your experience, a speech that was delivered many, many times, but only that was that time where it really, really worked? So, like, you know, at least the story that I know from the Martin Luther King with I Have a Dream, that he has delivered that speech many, many, many times, and it never worked. So when he started to, and it was a different draft written to him
right.
That particular day. So when that lady asked what Martin tell him your dream, and he started saying, I have a dream, the speechwriter said, oh no, not this. But it suddenly worked. Were there kind of, you know, speeches or moments in your career?
Yeah, you know, there's one set, it's interesting. So American presidents are always coming to Europe, they're always giving speeches. And in the course of his presidency, even after Russia invaded Ukraine the first time, he gave a series of speeches. He gave a speech in Brussels, where he was sort of in an auditorium with sort of a lot of EU leaders and staff, and it had to kind of, so he gave a speech there. He gave a speech in Warsaw, outdoor, open air, and he also gave a speech in Estonia, in Tallinn. And they were essentially the same three speeches. It's about American solidarity and commitment to Europe, especially in light of what was happening in Ukraine. But they were received, each one was received very differently. And I've often asked myself, why is that? Well, I think in the speech in Brussels, he was in Brussels. He was in a relatively safe place in Western Europe, and he was in an auditorium with kind of the elite of Europe.
Bureaucrats,
but not faceless bureaucrats. They all had faces. And in Warsaw, it was sort of the traditional kind of outdoor, open air, rah-rah kind of speech. But the one in Estonia, I think, resonated more with people for all sorts of reasons, one of which, the location. We've talked about sort of what really sets apart, you know, what makes a speech truly great. We talk about message, messenger, and moment. And in that case, the moment is, he's about 125 miles from the Russian border in a country where there's deep anxiety and fear of, you know, are we next? And so that speech, even though thematically it was very, very similar, you could read and watch all three speeches, they're very similar. That one popped and resonated in a way that the others hadn't. So, you know, I think same speechwriter, same speaker, essentially the same message, different location, slightly different time, different backdrop, all of a sudden it becomes, I'll give you one other quick example. President Obama gave a speech at the anniversary. He went to the Lincoln Memorial, stood where Martin Luther King stood, and gave a speech on the anniversary. And I was convinced going into it, I wasn't the lead speechwriter, this is going to be an epic speech. The first African-American president standing in that spot. It's got all the elements. Have you ever heard of that speech? A few months later, he goes to Selma, Alabama, where the famous Civil Rights March occurred. Bloody Sunday, they beat the hell out of the protesters. He's standing there with the bridge in the background, John Lewis, who got his head bashed in, and he gave essentially the same speech thematically that he had given at the Lincoln Memorial, and it's considered one of his best. And so go read both speeches and ask yourself what's happening. My view is he kind of told a different story at Selma. I mean, thematically it was all there. We've made a lot of progress. We are still falling short. We have a long way to go. I mean, these three kind of big, gigantic themes, they're both in all the places. But I think the backdrop and the power of that place and that moment helped the speech become something different. And again, same speaker, same message, same speech writers. One is you've never heard of, one is one of his best. So.
And I would like to come back to your speech of 2014 that you referred after Russia invaded Ukraine first time. Knowing, you know, that has, you know, been repeated, the invasion. Now looking back, would you change some of the wording knowing that it wouldn't be the first time they invade? I know it's not a speechwriting policy decision, but still.
You can only do what you can do in the moment, right? You know, you don't know what's coming. You can, so I don't mean to punt, but I honestly don't even know how to answer it. You know, like knowing what we know now, well, we didn't know what we know now. Mm. So you do your best in the moment.
And we discussed that a bit in your session about speeches being about hope. And how do you see, or you saw the evolution of speeches, you know, throughout the 10 years you were with the president? How would you describe, how would speeches look like? I mean, what will change? What you have noticed, how speeches change over those 10 years that you've been in the office?
How his speeches changed? Or
in general, you know, rhetorics in general. Hmm. I know that after Obama, right, it was a completely different type of rhetoric, but I mean, it's not what it is.
Right. Yeah, so I'm not really, you know, I'm not a professor of rhetoric, so I couldn't tell you how it's changed. What we're proud of is that if you look at his 2004 speech in Boston, which was sort of the beginning of his sort of national career, and his farewell address in January of 2017, thematically, they go together perfectly for a reason, because he didn't fundamentally change. His worldview didn't fundamentally change. His vision for the country was fundamentally the same. So as a speechwriter, you know, we talked about this in the workshop, every speech is just a scene, a chapter in one story, if you're doing it right. And you should be able to line them all up, and it'd be like reading a chapter of a book. So I would say, at least on the Obama piece of it, I don't think it I don't think there was a whole lot of evolution. I think if you listen to him in 2004 and you listen to him in 2017, the fundamentals are all the same. They're still there. And I think that, and that's not because of a lack of creativity or innovation. I think that's because we were being true to who we were working for. So I see that as a source of pride. It's a source of strength. I think that kind of consistency is good.
And we all know that the outgoing president usually writes a letter to the incoming one.
Right.
Do you do that as a speechwriter for the incoming speechwriter's team?
As speechwriter to speechwriter?
Yeah.
I guess the good answer would be, of course, we rose to the occasion, and I did not write a letter.
And I give you the last question, and then I will give also the opportunity for you to ask.
We've only got 5 minutes, but we'll do that then.
5 minutes, okay. So that will be also a short...
All right, we'll get short one-word answers.
Yeah, just, it would be kind of a feel-good moment for all of us, because, you know, for us, you are a star, you know, so...
Oh.
But could you tell a kind of a funny
that
story?
Pathos.
An embarrassing story?
Yeah. President was giving a speech in, he was going to Asia, giving a speech in Alaska on his way. I did not go on that trip. I was eating pizza with my family at a restaurant, and my BlackBerry goes off saying, the fact checkers caught a fact is wrong in the speech. And it's an important fact, and it will cause a major media explosion if he says it. So as I'm sitting eating pizza with my family, I'm asking the people, are you with him? Can you fix this? And that comes back, sorry, too late. He's already walking to the podium. And I'm like, well, there goes my job, you know. So I said, you know, something to the effect of, no, it has to be fixed. This will be really bad. And someone realized that there was still a way to fix it. And those of you who've worked with teleprompters know that even though, and thank God he was using a teleprompter that day, because if it had just been the book, there would have been no way to fix it. But you can go to the teleprompter, and even as the person is speaking and reading it on their screen, the person on the computer can pop it open, change the word, and never have it disrupt the flow. And so I was sort of waiting there with my pizza in my hand, waiting to see if I'd still have a job. And the person thankfully stood there and made sure the edit was made, and, you know, media catastrophe did not happen, and I still had a job. But there were a lot of moments like that. As I'm sure it is with presidents and prime ministers, and you serve at the pleasure of the president, and you're not protected by all the usual laws against discrimination and job hiring. And so if the president is not pleased, you're out. You're disappeared. And so you never know. And that was one of those moments where, there was another moment where, very quickly, I was writing, and he was either frustrated with me for not typing fast enough. He just kind of like ushered me aside, sat down at the computer, started typing. No one knows what he's typing. And he said, there, that's good. That, we'll just go with that. And so I had to sit back down and print it, you know, format it, make sure it's done. And the screen glitches. Black, and then comes back on, and it's on a different page. And I don't know what he's written, so I don't even know how to check to see if it's there. So I could do one of two things. I could be responsible and say to him, can you show me what you typed in? I want to make sure that it's still here. Or I could just hit print. And of course, I just hit print. I said, because he's saying, are we done? And I said, yep, we're done. We hit print. And I ran out. I left the building. I'm like, I'm not proud of the fact that he went to the podium, and I wasn't sure whether his edits were in the speech. But it's what happened in that moment. And it's how I emotionally reacted to that. And I just kind of hightailed it out and went home, and I said, maybe I'll be invited back on Monday, and maybe I won't. But I was, so.
You could have written, you are on your own now.
Right.
Are there any questions? Yeah.
Of course, President Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize very early in his presidency. And Sani was quite shocked, in a way, over this.
He was, too.
Yeah, and I also understand, I read that it was one of the more challenging speeches that you had to write, was really this speech he was supposed to hold at the ceremony in Oslo. I also read somewhere and heard that it was also, in the end, one of the speeches that he was most pleased with.
Yeah, we actually talked about that in the workshop, and it's fine. And but just very quick, one of the things that made it so challenging was he's getting a peace prize, and you just sent tens of thousands of troops to escalate a war. And so, but one of the my big takeaways from that is, you know, he went right to it, right to the central contradiction, and made the whole speech about that, the tension between war and peace and how you ensure peace, yet at times go war. So it's one of those lessons where you can, you know, you can hide from the things that are awkward and inconvenient, or you can embrace them. And those are some of the best speeches, I think, you know, when a CEO or a business, you know, don't hide from the elephant in the room, just make the elephant the star of the show and go there and talk about that, and you build credibility with your audience.
Hey. Well, thank you. Don't want to embarrass you personally, but I was wondering if you could reflect on your own journey from being someone who writes speeches for someone else to being someone who now, you know, lives from speaking to audiences like these and around the world. So your own journey from speechwriter to public speaker.
I think that'll be part of the book because, to be honest with you, maybe 2 years ago I couldn't have done this. There were times I stood up, I was shaking so much, the page, I just couldn't do it. I had spent 25 years writing for other people, helping them tell their story. I didn't know what my story was. I had spent all these years trying to internalize somebody else's voice. I didn't even know what my own voice was. I didn't know why would anyone be interested in what I had to say? Honestly, I truly felt that way. And you know, probably that self-doubt, I hope we all have that self-doubt in us, but, you know, through events like this, through Summer of Rhetoric conference in Finland, you know, I sort of have found, after a lot of hard work and a lot of practice, found my own voice. And I think we all have that in us. It can be very difficult sometimes to figure out what makes you. We've all got a story. We've all got a voice. And I try to use the time that I have now. I truly meant that. If I never write another speech again, I'm okay. I'm proud of the work I did. It's out there. People can like it. People cannot like it. And if I can use my time now to share some of these experiences, and you know, some people had to write speeches during the workshop. Some people are going through a really hard day, and this can be a very lonely profession and a hard profession, and you don't get the respect that you deserve, and everyone writes emails, so everyone thinks they can write a speech, and everyone wants to edit you, and they're not, and it's hard, and it's demoralizing, and I don't think there's anybody else in any other office in your organization who every day is pouring their heart and soul into this thing, and then putting it out, and everyone's ripping it apart. No one has to do that. You know, we don't get to edit the legal briefs, but the lawyers get to edit the speech. I mean, the world is insane. That's hard to do. And so if I can use my whatever time I have left to kind of share these experiences, and that I've been exactly where you are, it's been very demoralizing. I almost quit as a speechwriter many years ago. It was so hard. I didn't know what I was doing because I never took the course and I never read the book. So maybe I'll put it in a book. And I think you're not alone. You're not alone. So,
I definitely would continue, but
he's making
my head off. So I need to. I invite all of us to give a round of applause.